Last time I was out at Montpelier, I was talking to the quiz guy, Doug Smith, and I happened to mention that I was heading over to Europe soon for a trip. And he said, well, is that going to include Britain? And I said, well, of course it will. He said, oh, well, then let me set you up with some friends of mine. And through his good offices, I scheduled several very interesting interviews, many of which you're going to have the chance to hear on the show. And one in particular we're going to listen to today, actually two in particular. We're going to hear first from Heidi Kitson, a woman that Doug has known for many years and who works at a place called the University of Law in Guildford in England. And then we're going to hear from her colleague, Dan O'Boyle, who's a law professor over there. And he's going to tell us about that strange, amorphous, perhaps ephemeral thing we know as the British Constitution. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's all about really cool English accents.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches at the Appalachian School of Law.
One of the best things about working with all the great folks out at Montpelier is how everybody pitches in and everybody helps each other. And indeed, Montpelier, as a historic home, is part of a great network of historic sites and historic places. And of course, you know, there's an emphasis on constitutional history. And so it's no surprise when you go to another historic site, if you're over at Monticello or Mount Vernon or wherever, that you mention Montpelier. And chances are they know somebody that I know. And it's sort of like being in a club. I didn't realize that the club extended all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, but indeed it does, because my buddy the quiz guy, Doug Smith, when he found out recently I was heading over to England, he connected me with some great people over at the Benjamin Franklin House, and in a couple of weeks here I'm going to be talking and playing for you the interview I had with the wonderful people at the Benjamin Franklin House, where Benjamin Franklin actually lived for 16 years prior to the Revolution. Who knew? And also today we're going to speak first with an old friend of Doug's, Heidi Kitson, who works at a place called the University of Law in Guildford in England, which is just south of London, about an hour south of London. And Heidi was kind enough to set me up with a British law professor. His name is Dan O'Boyle. And Dan O'Boyle teaches British constitutional law. And that's really quite a trick, because there is no British constitution. Not exactly in the way that we think of a constitution. As Dan will explain in more detail later, while we have a single document that has been amended extensively, but it still can all be encapsulated in just a few pages, the British have not one document, but many different documents, from the Magna Carta to the Bill of Rights, the English Bill of Rights, including statutes and other things, and lots and lots of simply conventions and practices that are followed by Parliament, that are followed by the Queen, and which altogether are considered this thing, the British Constitution. I've known that for some time, but I've always had difficulty getting my head around it and how that could possibly work. And Dan O'Boyle explains it quite well. But first, Doug's old buddy, Heidi Kitson.
I'm Heidi Kitson. I'm the business development manager at the university, and we have 8 different campuses around the UK. We work primarily with postgrad lawyers or soon-to-be lawyers, as well as undergrad, which is a new program for us. We've been running for about 2 years now.
Well, Heidi, I must say I'm enormously disappointed, because you don't sound at all British. This is not what I expected. I traveled all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, and I sense that maybe I'm speaking to a fellow American.
Yes, I...
Good heavens.
I disappoint myself as well that I haven't picked up the British accent. I've been over here for a little over 10 years. I came here to do an undergrad after going to university in the States. Right. I wanted to... Hopefully not a midlife crisis, a little early for that, but wanted to live in Europe, and this was a way to do it, an expensive way to do it, but a way to do it,
right.
And I met my husband when I came over, so.
And you've got a couple of little British children.
I do, British and American.
British and American children,
dual citizenship,
right.
Now I worked hard to get those passports with the embassy, so.
And here you are in this lovely little town outside of London called Guildford, which I'd not heard of before, I must tell you, but this is just lovely. The University of Law is a lovely place.
It is. Guildford is actually very famous for Lewis Carroll, who lived here when he wrote Alice in Wonderland.
I did not know that.
Yeah,
is his house preserved or any of that? Any tourist stuff?
There are bits and pieces here and there, but I haven't been to that.
You've been too busy with your little British-American children and your British husband.
Yes.
That's tremendous. Well, you are, of course, not only are you American, but the great secret here, and one I didn't even realize until I got here, is that not only did Doug Smith of Montpelier, also known as our quiz guy, also known as our Riddler, not only did Doug Smith give me your name and email address, but the two of you were friends in high school.
Yes, absolutely.
So you are a high school friend of the quiz guy. Was he that much of a know-it-all in high school?
I can unequivocally say yes, he was.
Now, were you guys a romantic item?
Oh, I couldn't say.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to have to ask Doug about this next time. Tremendous. All right.
So you
all
go back. A lady never tells.
A lady never tells. Well, Doug's no gentleman, so that'll be easy to get it out of him. Tremendous. Okay, so the two of you go back a number of years.
We do.
And that's the connection here, and that's fantastic. And is there anything you wanted to tell me about you set up the interview we're about to hear with Dan O'Boyle.
Absolutely.
And I thank you for that. Is there anything else we should know about the university before I head over to the interview here? I mean, you've got campuses all over Britain, don't you?
We do. We have 8 campuses in most of the major cities, especially where you'll find large collections of lawyers.
Right.
We're opening a new center in Leeds, and we've got 2 branches in London. We have a branch in Guildford, Manchester. So we hit all of the main spots in the UK.
And you also have tractors galore, and we've been trying to avoid this one, but he's going to come back. So I think we are going to have to call this to a close.
That's
but
great.
I want to thank you very much, Heidi, for setting this up.
My pleasure. I'm happy to help.
Wasn't that great? Heidi was just a lovely lady. And toward the end there, you might have noticed that we had to stop because it was a beautiful day. And in fact, I had fantastic weather during the entire trip, including in England, where I expected to have to carry an umbrella. But we took advantage of the weather by standing outside for our talk. And then, lo and behold, there was this guy in the distance. He was sort of hovering around with a tractor and a trailer. And I kept worrying about him. And eventually, he did come, and we had to cut it off there. Be that as it may, Heidi was kind enough to set me up with a law professor by the name of Dan O'Boyle. And boy, did he have lots of interesting things to say. All about this strange thing we call the British Constitution.
One of the most interesting things, you know, that your listeners might find right from the outset is that in terms of our own constitution and your constitution, there's no sort of affinity that people have towards the constitution generally in this country.
The very idea that we would have a radio show called the British Constitutional
people
Weekly.
A lot of people would not be interested.
We do seem to do a little bit of reverence for our Constitution.
Yeah.
And maybe that's
because
it is a single document and there was a single founding moment. And it does have the big, it's on display at the National Archives
that's the big difference, I think, between the two constitutions, that we haven't had that single defining moment where we've ripped up what went before. We've got nothing to rip up anyway, because it's unwritten, and I'll explain that term in a moment. But we've not had that single defining moment, either that War of Independence or that revolution, as in France.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you've only chopped off one monarch's head.
We did, yeah. That's
only
right.
One, but
that's,
I mean, the French chopped off everybody.
Even then, that's known as the interregnum period.
Not a revolution.
Not a revolution, no. And even then, all that happened was they went back to what existed before they beheaded.
Just for the uninitiated, just give us the brief story there. Who was beheaded and what was that about?
Well, that was King Charles who was beheaded. And he had the nearest thing that we've ever had to a republic. But basically, you then had the return of the monarchy. You know, only a decade after the event.
Right.
And nothing, you know, major had happened to the Constitution. It was the same. It was
sort of a false start then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
a blip, we would call it.
It's more a blip. Yeah. A hiatus. Whatever term you want to use.
Okay. But I didn't mean to focus on that. I guess I was trying to pick up on your idea. We had a revolution.
Yeah.
11 years later, we formed our constitutional government.
Mm.
You didn't have that same progression.
No.
Instead, you had a much longer history where things happened much more gradually. So let's go to the beginning. How do people typically start
When's
the process?
Start of the,
When's the start of the British Constitution?
The most sort of perhaps famous, and it's quite interesting because it's not far from here, event early on, arguably, could be called the Magna Carta, which you might have heard of.
I think I've heard of it a couple of times. 1215, wasn't it?
1215, the Magna Carta. And that was when the barons said to the king, you know, we want to have certain powers and you're not going to be able to do certain things. And in fact, one of the fundamental constitutional rights that people have today is from the Magna Carta, which is a right to a jury trial. Now that's where it came from. That's where it came from. And the Magna Carta of 1215 is basically a constitutional act. So
that was King John. You say it was done not very far from here. Where was it done?
Not very far. Runnymede.
Runnymede, and that's how far is it?
About 45 minutes away.
Really?
Yeah, I've got colleagues who live, you know, a stone's throw from where that happened.
Tremendous. Have they preserved anything there? Is there any sort of monument?
Yeah, there's the centre. And we're coming up next year, 1215?
So yeah, it is. Wow.
To a big event next year.
Yeah,
big event next year. So there'll be lots of education.
Just like 800
stuff.
Years?
Yeah,
wow.
800 years since the signing of the Magna Carta.
We'll have to come back for that.
Absolutely. But I mean, that's one of the sources of our constitution is statute. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, a prime example of a constitutional act. That's one of the sources of our constitution, because like you said, we don't have a written constitution. We have an unwritten constitution in the sense that there's no single authoritative document. And the constitution in the UK is derived from a variety of sources. Four key sources, to put it simplistically, would be case law, statute, which is acts, conventions, which I'll explain that term later, and what's known as the royal prerogative, which is, again, is another term that I'll explain later. And from those four terms, you've got actually, you can say that the Acts of Parliament are in writing, so there is a written source.
Right. In fact, it started with a written source.
Yeah, in fact, you could say it started with a written source.
So it is written in the sense that parts of it are written
parts
down,
of it
the
are
statutory
written.
Parts.
Yeah, parts of it are written, and parts are unwritten. Mm-hmm. You could say that the case law, there'll be somewhere where that case was recorded. You know, one of the key cases from the 17th century was when it's the Entick versus Carrington case, 1685, when basically the king ordered his men, if you like, to go into someone's house and search it and search for, you know, what he delicately termed seditious material, you know, mm-hmm. which would be just anti-monarchical material that was perceived as such back then. And a writ was brought against the minister. And the law was established, fundamental constitutional law, that if the government wished to either arrest anyone or to search their premises, then they would have to point to a legal authority for that. And there was no legal authority that existed for that actual search at that time or the arrest of that individual. They didn't have any legal ground for it.
So this is where a warrant requirement first came up.
We have to
go to a judge and get him to give you the legal authority.
Well, not so much that, but they had to have a legal authority to point to that gave that power. That's what it meant.
Wow. Search and seizure.
Yeah.
That's in our Fourth Amendment. That's where that came from.
Absolutely.
What was the name of that case again?
Entick versus Carrington.
In 1685.
Yeah.
Wow. Important case.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, that's another, you know, key constitutional case.
I'm going to interrupt you here. In our country, it's a controversial idea that judges make law.
Yep.
In fact, we have a great segment of our society that is constantly concerned about what it calls judicial activism. Mm. It's one of those really malleable terms that means essentially what you want it to mean.
Yep.
But if it has any meaning at all, it's that judges are supposed to interpret the law, not make it. And yet, it's unavoidable that judges make law if there's no precedent that controls or there's no statute that specifies. And so then you're much more upfront about it here in Britain, is that that's the case, that's where it came from.
Yes, but I mean, we still have this argument about judicial activism because you see sometimes a clash between the judiciary and the legislature in this country, particularly with the creation of the Human Rights Act in 1998, and when that kicked in on the 1st of October 2000, and the ability of the highest court in the land to declare an act of Parliament as incompatible.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with Dan O'Boyle, who's a law professor at the University of Law in Guildford in England. And we're talking all about this strange idea, this strange concept that we call the British, which they call the British Constitution. There are lots of differences, but as we've just seen, there are some things that are very similar, such as controversies over judicial activism and even the concept of judicial review. After the break, we'll talk some more with Dan O'Boyle, and I think you're really going to like it. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with British law professor Dan O'Boyle from the University of Law in Guildford in England. And we've been talking about the British Constitution, but the British Constitution isn't like our Constitution. It's not all written down in one document or one document and some amendments that are all collected together. It's actually spread across a number of documents that actually go back about 800 years. So if you want to study the British Constitution, you got to go all the way back at least to 1215 in the Magna Carta. You got to talk about things that happened way back in the 1600s, and then you've got to understand the history and trace it through. And before we left, Dan was just about to tell us about a major constitutional development.
A key development and a massive constitutional change in this country was brought about because of the clash between the monarchy and parliament in the 17th century. And that culminated in 1689 with the Bill of Rights, when parliament invited William of Orange over from Holland to take the crown on the proviso that he signed the Bill of Rights, which basically laid the groundstone for the ascendancy of Parliament over the monarchy. It reduced the monarchical powers massively.
You started out with, at least in theory, an absolute sovereign.
Yeah.
The divine right of kings.
Yeah,
God anointed someone, and he's going to be the king, and then everybody fought over who was the properly anointed king.
That's right.
And then at a certain point, this body, these barons got together and decided they wanted to share some of the king's power. That was the Magna Carta.
Yeah, that's right.
And then later you have the establishment of Parliament, which is a house that, correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm just trying to run through it quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a House of Lords and a House of Commons.
Yeah.
Okay. And bit by bit, you can say much of British constitutional history from that point forward was the struggle between Parliament and the King.
Mm.
And what I just heard you say was that in about 1689, Parliament really took the lead with the establishment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They said, you got another succession battle.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, William of Orange, come on over. You can be our king, but here are our conditions. Basically, we're the bosses from this point forward.
Basically.
So that was an extremely important moment.
In a nutshell, I mean, there's still massive power held by the monarchy. But what you had, for example, established in the Bill of Rights was freedom of speech in Parliament.
Just in Parliament?
Just in Parliament.
Parliament,
But that still stands. Mm-hmm. That still stands. And what that means, basically, is that an MP can say what he wants about whom in Parliament without fear of prosecution whatsoever. It's known as parliamentary privilege.
Wow.
And also, you had Article 9, which said that no one or nobody can question an act of Parliament. So that meant that the King couldn't strike down an act of Parliament.
That's important.
Basically, it established... it gave statutory footing, if you like, to a principle that had developed over previous years of what's known as parliamentary supremacy. If you like, the ultimate reference point for us is in terms of our constitution is often seen as Parliament because of the doctrine of parliamentary supremacy rather than a written constitution. That's the ultimate reference point.
Wow. So the ultimate body that determines what your constitution is and what your constitution means, then, is Parliament, or at least Parliament thinks so.
Yeah.
Ever since 1689 with the establishment of this Bill of Rights.
Yeah, if you like. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Although, you mentioned judicial activism. And
right.
We've also got a very important constitutional principle that's developed in this country known as the rule of law.
Right.
And that means...
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, and your listeners, you know, basic understanding is it does what it says on the tin, which is that everyone's subject to the laws of the land, you know, including the Prime Minister and whoever. So there are some judges in recent cases who have said that actually the ultimate reference point is not parliamentary supremacy, it is the rule of law. Because, and they give one judge whose name escapes me at the moment, he said in an obiter part of his judgment, which is basically the point that was not relevant to the issues to be decided. Mm-hmm. So when a judge goes off a tangent,
obiter dictum, right?
Yeah, obiter dictum. Yeah, just for your listeners,
the obiter dictum is when a court says something or writes something that, strictly speaking, is not necessary for the resolution of a case. It can be derided and dismissed as simply the judge ranting. On the other hand, it can also be a very important opportunity, especially for a higher court, to give guidance on future cases. So as I like to tell my students, there's dictum and then there's important dictum. Mm. And in our country, the Supreme Court of the United States, if they can say something in dictum, I mean, that really is law. Whereas if some lower court judge just starts talking about baseball in his opinion, that doesn't have any effect. At any rate, that's what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
okay. That's what I'm talking about. And this judge said it was actually in the Hunting Act case, which was a big thing.
The Hunting Act case? When was that?
Well, if I just say what the principle was that he said on the rule of law, he said that basically if Parliament passed a law that went against what he called, again delicately used the term, constitutional fundamentals, such as the right to bring a judicial review, the courts would step in and strike down that act. Now that's the first time where a judge has said they would step in and strike down an act.
When was that?
That was the Attorney General versus Jackson in I think it's 2000.
Okay, we keep coming back to that case. Yeah. Wow, it is fascinating. I mean, I'm trying to stay chronological here, and I understand, but sometimes these things don't lend themselves to straight chronological analysis. We call that, of course, judicial review.
Yeah.
And in our country, we have a tradition of what we call strong judicial review. That is, it was established as of 1803 in Marbury versus Madison. Mm. That the Supreme Court of the United States is the ultimate arbiter of what our Constitution means, and that means they can declare any act of the President or Congress or any state unconstitutional. And so in one sense they're the ultimate authority of everything. But you're saying that in Britain that concept was not clearly articulated until 2000.
Arguably it still doesn't exist.
Wow. You know, so I mean, a court said it, but people haven't actually
said it, but Parliament hasn't ever. it's a bit of an academic point, because Parliament is democratically elected,
right?
You know, and and the chances of an extreme party like the British National Party ever getting in, which is basically fundamentally a racist party,
right?
The chances of them ever getting in are incredibly remote. But what that judge was saying was that, you know, if there was, you know, a government that dominated the legislature that was going to do something extreme like take away the right to bring a judicial review, the Supreme Court judges would strike it down. And that's also, you know, known as, or bolsters, if you like, our independent judiciary. Because I know when the American Constitution was drafted, you know, you didn't want to have any blurring of the lines that was seen as a problem with our Constitution, with the UK Constitution, where you had the executive dominating the Constitution, basically.
Well, you have Parliament, and Parliament elects the executive from within its own ranks. I mean, that's the basic difference between a parliamentary system and a presidential system, is that there's no direct election of your chief executive here.
That's right, yeah.
Right? I mean, if our Congress got together and instead of simply electing a Speaker of the House and a Senate Majority Leader, they elected one person and said, now you are the President.
Or the Prime Minister,
it would be.
Yeah, that's known as the convention, because I mentioned that term earlier. Mm-hmm. Convention, that's basically a non-legal rule of constitutional behaviour. And what we mean by, you know, that's essentially what a convention is.
Just a way of doing
business. Just a way of doing things. And it can appear and disappear. It's quite flexible.
Wait a minute. So there's nothing written down anywhere that says that you have to have a prime minister?
No, that's just evolved over time.
Seriously? So Parliament just decided tomorrow, we don't like this prime minister idea, we're just going to vote on everything.
It would create a constitutional crisis if they did that.
Who would live at 10 Downing Street?
Well, our safety net is the Queen. You know, is she a safety net or not? You know,
right?
I mean, legally. a lot of powers the Queen still has, but it's by convention that she doesn't exercise those powers. Legally, if the Queen wanted to tomorrow, she could appoint as Prime Minister Prince Harry.
Really?
Legally, in law, there's nothing to stop that. But obviously that would be just unacceptable, and it would lead to a constitutional crisis, which might even lead to the abolition of the monarchy. So it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of how our Prime Minister becomes Prime Minister, it's basically the convention is the leader of the majority party in the House of Commons becomes Prime Minister. The Queen appoints them as Prime Minister, but it's an appointment by the Queen under her royal prerogative power.
So she is simply, effectively, every time she appoints a new Prime Minister, she's simply agreeing to maintain the convention of accepting the choice that the Parliament
people,
has made.
Yeah, well, but people have made that choice because the people have voted generally. A big factor in influencing voting in this country will be, and nowadays, it's a personality, as it's been in the States, you know, for a long time and mm-hmm. in this country for a long time.
That's funny you should mention that. I was just yesterday at the Churchill Museum. Hmm. And most Americans still are shocked to this day that Churchill was defeated for re-election in the summer of 1945, you know, just after having saved the Western world and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But it's a bit more nuanced than that. What happened was that his party was turned out.
That's right.
The Labour Party simply got more votes.
They decided it was time for Labour to come in and, you know, and do the rebuilding.
Right, and so and Labour's leader was Clement Attlee, and so he became the next Prime Minister.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
It's basically you're picking a general direction, and in fact, it's millions and millions of individual decisions in dozens, hundreds of different districts. That then elect a new parliament,
that's right.
And then the new parliament simply has a different direction and a different leader.
Districts are known as constituencies.
Right. You know, and so it wasn't specifically that they said, we don't want Churchill. No. It was that we would rather have Labour's policies.
Yeah, it's the Labour's policies.
Right.
Probably Labour at that time was talking about rebuilding, you know, more than the Tories.
Right.
You know,
and the king at the time, because you had a king at that point.
Oh, yes.
It's in 1945. The king then simply said, okay, according to this constitutional convention, I'm going to appoint Mr. Attlee as my next prime minister.
Yeah, legally, he could have, if he'd wanted to, the king at that time could have said, no, Churchill, you stay. But then there would have been a constitutional crisis.
Yeah, rather.
Uproar in Parliament.
Yeah.
You know, and why is the king doing this? Because the convention really just, if you like, gives effect to... the will of the people, the electorate, in electing that party. Although it's not directly electing the leader, effectively, a big thing that influences people, you know, is the personality of the leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you had in the States with Obama, and as you have in this country currently, you know, difference between, well, neither of them are particularly charismatic, but David Cameron and Ed Miliband, but David Cameron's just marginally more charismatic.
So these days, of course, with mass communication, the personality and the magneticism, if you will, of the party leader can really help his or her party, but it's not necessarily going to determine the outcome of the election.
No.
Very, very interesting.
No.
Okay, so now that's another big difference. Now, have we skipped over any of these other major constitutional concepts?
Constitutional sources. What have we spoken about?
We're talking about statutes.
Statutes. We've got case law, which we've mentioned.
Right.
And the last one was a royal prerogative.
Yes, the royal prerogative.
Okay. And the royal prerogative is basically rooted in common law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's an interesting one. Because
now, you mentioned a term. Every American has heard the term common law.
Yeah.
We at least define it as judge-made law.
That's all it is, yeah.
Okay, again, if a judge is confronted with a circumstance that traditionally he, but these days he or she, finds novel, mm-hmm. Or the statute's ambiguous, mm-hmm. or whatever, the judge has to make a decision, and that decision can then set a precedent. Mm. And once a precedent gets firmly ensconced in the law, then we call it part of the common law. And again, it's unavoidable. It's part of a judge's job. So you're saying that over centuries, the common law of Britain has developed a sense of the royal prerogative.
Part of the common law is known as the royal prerogative, yeah.
Okay, now tell us what this is.
Okay, the royal prerogative basically is powers that were once personally exercised by the monarch, by medieval monarchs, that are now, in general, exercised by the government on behalf of the crown. So, to give an example, the government will make a declaration of war. So as Tony Blair did in 2003, wasn't it, Iraq?
Yeah, Iraq. Yeah, that was a controversial one, in both of our countries. But
He made the declaration. He made the decision to deploy our armed forces into that situation. And that's known as a royal prerogative power. And he was exercising that power on behalf of the monarch. It's nowhere written down again that there's never been a case on this. It's just accepted.
Right.
So if that's, you know, what's happened is it's an example of the monarchy losing its powers and government, parliament assuming those powers instead. Because as your listeners will be aware, the Queen's powers are largely symbolic in this country.
So essentially the royal prerogatives have one by one been assumed by the government, by the parliament.
Yeah, most of them.
There's
still some that are exercised personally.
What real power does your monarch still have? I mean, other than just the obvious reverence that people have for her and for the family and her traditional position in society, which can be very influential.
Yeah.
Okay, but beyond that, what are the real powers?
I mean, her role is basically, as far as I see it, it prevents us needing a president. It's either a president or a monarchy, and the monarchy, is quite a good pulling factor for the tourists.
I was just outside of Buckingham Palace yesterday, and I took my selfie with my son there in front of it. So I know exactly. You got a few of my dollars yesterday.
Yeah.
So is that all the Queen is? Is basically a tourist magnet?
No. That's I'm being a little bit flippant. But I mean, there are still parts of our constitution that she's important to. So an example is. For an act of parliament, so for the Human Rights Act that was passed on the 2nd of October 2000, for that to become an act of parliament, it had to be passed by the House of Commons, the lower chamber, and then the House of Lords, and then it needed the royal assent. So it needed the Queen to sign on a dotted line to say this is now hitting the statute book.
Right. And did she do that?
Yeah, she did that. Yeah. Because of a constitutional convention, which means that she won't refuse to do that. Unless advised to do so by the Prime Minister.
Let me get this straight now. So, Parliament passes an act, both the House of Commons, House of Lords.
Yeah.
Prime Minister takes it over to the Queen, and he says, Your Majesty, I really don't think you should sign this.
He wouldn't ever do that.
Okay. But he could.
Again, legally, is that possible?
Yeah.
Is that a possibility? But it would not happen, because the convention is... That she will. The last time was over 300 years ago when I think Queen Anne refused to sign an act. It was probably something undermining the powers of the monarchy at the time. I can't remember explicitly what it was, but
that's the last time it happened.
That's the last time it happened.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with British law professor Dan O'Boyle, and he's telling me all about the British Constitution. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with Dan O'Boyle. Stick around.
Now, if you huff and puff and you finally save enough money up to take your family on a trip across the sea, take a tip before you take your trip. Let me tell you where to go. Go to England, oh. England swings like a pendulum do. Bobby's on bicycles, 2x2. Westminster Abbey, the Tower of Big Ben, the rosy red cheeks of the little children.
Montpelier is the site of many annual events. The annual Montpelier Hunt Races, an autumn steeplechase event, were started by Marion DuPont Scott and her brother William DuPont Jr. in 1934. The races are held the first Saturday in November. Montpelier has one of the few steeplechase tracks in the country that use traditional hedgerows for jumps. The Montpelier Wine Festival showcases distinctive arts and crafts, specialty food vendors, local agricultural products, and Virginia wine from approximately 25 different wineries in the state. The Fall Fiber Festival is held each October and showcases every aspect of textile manufacturing, from the production of wool to the finished product, and the sheepdog trials. Other events include summer programs for children, a barbecue held in the summer, archaeology expeditions, Civil War demonstrations, and a candlelight tour of Montpelier in the evening. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with British law professor Dan O'Boyle, who's telling us all about the British Constitution. And it's really hard for Americans to understand that this is a concept that spans many documents and many conventions, many common practices, and that those things ultimately rest. And this is something that Dan and I sort of discuss coming up here, ultimately rest on the basic premise that the public, the populace, is sovereign.
Now, I know that your queen is your sovereign, okay? But effectively, that sovereign power has devolved. You correct me if I'm wrong, because this is just my interpretation of it. I'm trying to understand it from our perspective. That sovereignty has effectively devolved to the people. And so if ever any constitutional actor, from the queen to the prime minister to any government official, does something that truly offends the popular opinion, then the people will, one way or the other, resolve it in their favor. That's, and they'll do it through a process that you've mentioned as a constitutional crisis. I mean, if your prime minister advises the queen not to sign an act that Parliament's passed, I imagine there'd be an uproar in Parliament.
Massive uproar, yeah.
There would be a very quick replacement of that party leader.
Yeah, that party leader would be sacked by his party.
Or maybe the whole party would be voted out at the next election.
And it would probably precipitate a general election. So
right, and then eventually the people would reassert their power. Okay, so ultimately the power is, to borrow a phrase, the power is in the people. So government actors all know this, and that's what keeps them driving between the lines.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, we've maintained the status quo of having an unwritten constitution, because it seems to work.
It does seem to work. And in fact, I'm going to bring up an American analogy. Many Americans find it remarkable that the very fellow who wrote our Bill of Rights, James Madison, initially opposed having a Bill of Rights. And his theory was this: look, a Bill of Rights is only appropriate when you've got a sovereign who has a history of having repressed the people. We have a popular government. There's no need for it. And moreover, and this is the relevant part, simply writing down a list of rights, that they become parchment barriers. All that's important is that the people ultimately are jealous of those rights. And if any government actor violates those rights to a great enough degree, that the people will rise up and change their government one way or the other. They'll vote them out of office, or they'll do whatever they're going to do. And that's Madison recognized an essential truth there. It's fine to write things down, but unless people understand their rights and people are jealous of those rights, there are always going to be government actors that will take those rights away. And so ultimately, the ultimate check on government power is the people themselves. And so this idea of having, as you say, an unwritten constitution makes a great deal of sense. And it works very well, and it works well because ultimately the British people are not going to stand for anybody to do too much out of the ordinary. Okay, is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. I mean, I could say something controversial, you know.
Please, controversy is great. Love controversy.
About the right to bear arms, for example.
We certainly have a lot of controversy in our country about that.
I mean, that was a brilliant idea back in,
1791.
Sorry, 1791.
Quite all right.
When you had anarchy. You know, and people should be entitled to, you know, to defend their property. Their properties were at high risk, you know, in that society, I guess, at that time. But, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's been a number of administrations that have tried to, you know, alter, say, the gun laws in the States.
In the 20th century, primarily, a lot of states and localities have tried to put various limitations on arms, especially handguns. As a way to combat crime. And those have been challenged repeatedly. And in 2008, for the first time in our constitutional history, the Second Amendment, which makes explicit reference to a militia, was read by our Supreme Court to establish an individual right to keep and bear arms. And that was always the great constitutional question. Does that Second Amendment simply mean that you can be a member of a militia and bring your gun with you? Or does it mean that, no, regardless
of... But what does the word militia mean?
Well, you want to talk about controversy? I think it's fair to say, and there are people on both sides of this issue, it's fair to say that the Heller decision, District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008, pretty much read out of existence what they called the prefatory clause of the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. they essentially decoupled those two. Right. And that's still very controversial to this day. But, you know, until the Supreme Court changes its mind, that is the law of our land now. Yeah. There is an individual right. But it was only in 2008 it was established.
Okay.
So we
That's one myth that's gone.
Sorry, what?
For me, I always thought that individuals had the right to bear arms in the States.
Many people have long felt that way. And you want to talk about conventions? We had a frontier that is, you know, started at the East Coast and moved toward the West Coast, at least from the British perspective.
Yeah.
And often on the frontier, people kept and bore arms. I mean, think of your old Western movies.
Mm.
You know, and you know, the cowboy shows up in town with his two six guns. Mm. So we've had a long societal tradition of individual gun ownership. But did our Constitution provide for that? That was actually not resolved until 2008.
Okay, that's interesting.
I'm sorry. This is about your constitution, mine. Okay.
No, I was just drawing comparisons between the ability to change constitutions. Because if we wanted to pass an act saying that you could not have in your house anymore a gun, then Parliament could just pass an act if it wanted to.
And that's what really gets me, and that's a big difference here, is that, and in fact, one level of comfort that I get from having a written constitution and having strong judicial review is that the judiciary really does check the Congress. And so if Congress does something, in fact, frequently it happens, they'll pass a statute and it'll be challenged in some court. And in the words of our famous Chief Justice John Marshall, the job of the Supreme Court is to place the Constitution on the table and place the statute next to it and decide if they're consistent or not.
Yeah.
And that didn't come up until the Human Rights Act of 2000 here in your country.
That's right.
And
the interesting thing about the Human Rights Act is there's still no power that the courts have to strike down an act.
They have it.
But no, they don't.
They don't say they have it.
They don't say that because they don't have the power to strike down an act as unconstitutional. What they do is they make a declaration of incompatibility.
Of incompatibility
with the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, that does not invalidate the Act. The Act is still good law, but what happens is that, again, another convention that's developed, a non-legal constitutional rule, the government, through its majority in Parliament, and by convention, it will always change the offending Act. It will use referred to as a fast-track procedure in Parliament.
We'll just send it back and fix it.
To change, to take out the offending part of the Act. So, for example, when you had the famous Belmarsh detainee case in 2000 in this country.
Okay, what was that about?
The Belmarsh case was about a group of suspected foreign nationals who were being indefinitely detained.
That's a big issue in our country
but that happened in Belmarsh prison, which is a category A prison where they keep
maximum security prison.
Very dangerous individuals, and these individuals had not been charged with anything. They had simply been detained indefinitely under the Terrorism Act of 2000. And that was deemed in 2005, much to the disgust of the Blair government and the Home Secretary at the time, Charles Clark, that was deemed to be incompatible with the right to liberty under the Human Rights Act.
So the judiciary said, okay, guys, go back and change this.
He said, you've got no right to detain them because you've not put them before a court.
Right.
Put them before a court. You've got to prosecute them if you're going to, detain them, and also it was held to be, interestingly enough, discriminatory as well because it only applied to foreign nationals.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah. So, and the great irony was that when we had our moment of the July bombings in the summer in London, they were all UK nationals. So that legislation that was passed could not have prevented what happened anyway. But that was,
So it was declared incompatible, and did Parliament then go back and change
Parliament
it?
Parliament went back and changed it, and you had control orders instead of indefinite detention. So you had...
That's very interesting. You know, we've got a system with this supposedly strong judicial review that looks, in many respects, like it's a much stricter standard. I mean, you really do have the judges basically saying, that's unconstitutional, that's not, strike that part of this law, or don't apply it this way. And, of course, most Americans think that's just a wonderful system. And Americans will look at the British system and say, well, how can you keep your parliament under control then if you don't have an independent judiciary that's going to strike things down? I'm wondering if perhaps our system almost encourages congressional irresponsibility. knowing that, the, you know, if they go too far, something will be struck down. Whereas your parliament realizes it's the got the ultimate authority, and maybe that keeps people a little bit more moderate in their actions than our Congress.
Well, that, you see, that authority that the parliament has, that ability to pass any law whatsoever on any subject has been watered down significantly. Going back to the European Communities Act 1972 when we joined the European Union.
Yeah, you guys are already complicated enough, and now you've done all this European Union stuff, and that gives another level of review and authority that we're just completely unfamiliar with. So give us the thumbnail sketch of that.
Oh, gosh, that's a big one in itself. Well, basically, Edward Heath made a decision to join the European Union.
This was back in the 70s?
Back in the 70s.
Right.
And on the 1st of January 1973, the European Communities Act kicked in. And that meant that some laws that would be directly applicable in the UK were made elsewhere other than Westminster.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That must have prompted a huge debate.
Yeah, it did. It did. It did. It did.
I mean, it's almost impossible for me to imagine the United States agreeing to that level. I think people would deride it as a surrender of sovereignty is what they would do. And I imagine
and
there were people here.
That's what the UK Independence Party in this country is now saying.
We never should have done that.
But, I mean, the great irony is that you cannot undo what's happened in the past with that act. So I'll give you an example. You know, I'll set that in context as what I mean by that. As a result of that, we got incredibly closely economically tied into Europe, and lots of our laws, became rooted in, were rooted originally in EU law. So. You could say lots of favourable employment legislation for employees, equality of rights for the sexes. You know, that's driven from Europe. Now, that's something, say, that, you know, people who are anti-Europe don't, you know, just gloss over and just talk about the strange rules that have come, you know, from Europe, like the banana has got to be a certain size or whatever. Whatever sort of urban myth, you know, you want to cite.
Let's just dispel that now. Is there actually a banana size restriction that's emanated from Europe?
I don't know.
But the point here is that when you tie yourself to another group of nations, then to some extent you're giving up control. Now, you make a reasoned judgment that it's better for your country on balance to be united with this other entity. But nonetheless, the price of that is that when the other entity does things that maybe you don't like, you've agreed in advance you're going to abide by those rules.
That's right.
And that's surrender of sovereignty.
It is.
I mean, it really is. Yeah, I mean, it might be good and it might be bad, but that's what's going on.
But it works both ways. Yeah.
Right. Well, then why do you still have British pounds rather than euros, necessitating my switching two different foreign currencies and making my life much more difficult as a visitor to your shores?
Yeah.
Is that just one thing? You refuse to go that far. That was it. It was just too much. We still have to have the Queen's portrait on our money.
What I think a lot of it's rooted in is the fact that we are not part of the continent. You know, we are an island, and we have that island mentality in some ways historically rooted, you know, in us, and the fact that if, to me, I wouldn't care if I was using the euros in this country or if I was using the pounds. To me, it's just a currency,
right?
And I mean, and to be honest, you know, the longer things as the years go by, you're using cash less and less often anyway.
Right.
Soon you're just going to be, you know, just using your mobile phone probably to pay for everything.
Probably,
Or just one card, you know. So, I mean, I don't have that emotional attachment to our currency that and a lot of, say, you know, people won't have, I don't think.
Right.
There'll be lots of people that do. But there's just some people that become completely irrational in this country when you mention the word the European Union. You know, they're just
These are emotional issues. I mean, it's wrapped up in people's sense of identity frequently.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, I am an American, or I'm a British subject, or I'm a German, And if that is truly how you view yourself, then it doesn't cut it to say, I'm part of the European community.
But I mean, when you strip it away and look at historically, you know, who is British? Well, you know, and who's American? We're from a collection of countries originally anyway, you know, from European countries, you know, from different countries. So, I mean, yes, you have, you know, an identifying nationality. But say British culture, I think it's quite interesting, and American culture, because it takes from different parts of the world, and part of the great thing I think about this country is, you know, although sometimes we aren't always tolerant, but it's generally the idea that we're a tolerant society, mm-hmm. you know, that you know, reasonably progressive.
All of this is part of that process that we often talk about in economic terms, but it's also social, it's globalization. And one of the things that you might find amusing is that what you call football and we call soccer is becoming increasingly popular in our country. In fact, this most recent round of the World Cup, for the first time in my lifetime, I noticed people sitting around in big groups
watching
in bars, talking about it around the water cooler. And that very social shift has become controversial because there are those, especially on the far right of the political spectrum, who see that act as somehow a surrender of sovereignty. Yeah. We should all be watching baseball or American football, but American, by golly, not this other international sport. And so these are emotional issues.
So people lose their sense of, you know, of being rational about them.
But, I mean, there are some certainly some advantages to currencies that are standardized, and you don't have to worry about all the exchange. You don't have to worry about exchanging your paper and coins when you go across.
Because I'm going to France tomorrow, and I've got to nip into town at some point today to get some euros, which is really irritating. I've got lots of work to do. I'd be quite happy to have euros here. Uh-huh. Just take them over there. But that's just my own mindset, because I'm quite pragmatic about life.
Well, you do remind me of something, and that is that I'm imposing upon you, Dan. You've been very kind to sit down with me on the eve of your holiday when you've got all sorts of things you're trying to tie up and talk to me. Is there anything else about the British Constitution that we should talk about before we conclude this?
No, I think we've covered, you know, most of it. You know,
well, then let's summarize it, and I'm going to let you do it. What are these four basic concepts again, and of the so-called unwritten British Constitution?
Well, the sources.
The sources,
like,
of four basic,
rather than a single authority document. You've got case law, which is judge-made law. Mm-hmm. You've got Acts of Parliament, which is statute,
right,
passed by the legislature. You've got the royal prerogative, which is, if you like, the residue, the leftover discretionary powers of medieval monarchs mm-hmm. that are now exercised by the government on behalf of the crown, generally. Mm-hmm. And you've got constitutional conventions, which are basically just non-legal rules of constitutional behaviour. So legally, they can't be enforced, but they are observed nevertheless. And the reason why is because of the consequences that would happen if they were not. Just to give that example, if the Queen decided, you know, to appoint legally her dog as Prime Minister tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. How about me? I would do that.
But I'm
not a subject. I mean, she does what she wants, right?
She could legally appoint whoever or whatever she wants as Prime Minister. But the convention says you don't do that. You appoint the leader of the political party. With a majority, or best able to command a majority in the House of Commons.
Right. So those four sources of the British Constitution, not written down in one place, and as you say, it seems to work pretty well for you.
It seems to.
And it does one other thing you haven't mentioned, is that it is sort of an employment security act for people like you, because this is very difficult for American ears to understand, and I imagine for British ears as well. And so they're always going to need somebody to explain this, and you've done a tremendous job of doing so, Dan.
Yeah, that
would be. So I thank you very, very much for your time.
Yeah, I hope your listeners enjoy it.
And that's our show on the British Constitution. Do you understand it now? Maybe just a little bit? Well, I certainly do, or at least I understand it better than I used to. So thanks very much to Dan O'Boyle of the University of Law at Guildford. Thanks also to Heidi Kitson of the University of Law at Guildford, who set up all of this. And thanks even to our quiz guy, Doug Smith. He's the guy who hooked me up with these people to begin with, and And Doug's a nice guy. He does a good job. So thanks, Doug. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. And our Madison Minute is done by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, and maybe a little bit of the British, too.